From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Everything is under control. When I picked up a copy of Phyllis Grant's book of that title, it was early April, and I was in the first wave of COVID denial and acceptance. Looking at the words on the cover, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Everything was so not under control. For years, when I've read certain cookbooks or memoirs or essays about a life in food, I thought to myself, these words can really speak directly for the author. I mean, they wrote the words. That's how I felt about Phyllis Grant's book, a memoir written unlike any other. It's a combination of poetry and short prose pieces that explore different chapters of her life, from ballet and anorexia to working a hotline and having children. I asked her to come on the show and read a few passages for us. So here she is, reading from Everything is Under Control.
Here, there is no intense heat. I whack the cold dough with my rolling pin. There is no chef. I lean all my weight into the flattened disc. No dupes. Roll, spin, quick flip, flour, exhale. There is no judgment. No sweat. No VIPs. My heart starts to race. There are only my children, perched on stools, trying to control their eager hands, excited to fill their hungry bellies.
And now let's go back to your first apartment kitchen.
It's small. It's filled with roaches. It's coated with the stink and stickiness of the previous 10 tenants. But it's mine. My first kitchen, with a gas stovetop and an oven with a broiler drawer. The freezer has a 2-inch border of ice, but it's big enough for 2 pints of ice cream for my new roommate and me. I have a place to collect condiments. I buy a dish towel and an apron. I open my mom's recipe book and follow her cursive through the chopping of the onions, the toasting of the rice, the never ever lifting off of the lid until the timer goes off. I end up with a pot of brown rice. Her words work.
And now you're a nanny and you walk by a restaurant and see the chefs outside on break.
My rocking and yammering have put the baby to sleep. I turn the corner and see the models and the lawyers and the Wall Streeters slipping out of limos and into a restaurant. I sneak in the front door. The air smells fancy, fermented. I leave before anyone sees me and go around to the back. Cooks slip out to lean against the brick wall to take quick drags of cigarettes. They all seem rushed and guilty. Each opening of the kitchen door lets me sneak a peek into their bright world. I watch an army of cooks in crisp white shirts and aprons, red-faced, sweating, barking out orders, heads down, arms reaching and stirring, plucking herbs and flipping fish and testing sauces with tasting spoons. The industrial kitchen fan pumps a mashup of lunch fumes out into the alley. I want my hair to smell like chocolate and garlic and fish. I want to lean in and carefully place the roasted beets next to the potato puree. I want a purpose. I rock the baby, hugging him tight. His back to my belly. All I want is to unstrap him, hand him to the next person walking by, enter the kitchen, and never look back.
Wow, I so love this book. Did the kitchen life last long for you?
No, you know, it didn't, but it was sort of like cramming 10 years into about 3 years. It was kind of an accelerated situation because I was working in New York City at a 4-star restaurant, so it was just so intense. 6 days a week, 16-hour days on your feet, lots of stress, working till 2, 3, 4 in the morning sometimes, and waking up and then doing it all over again. So I burned out pretty quickly, but I did get a lot of experience in a very short amount of time.
And do you find that that experience, despite the burnout, keeps coming back to you as you go through different parts of your life?
Well, I think in some ways it just confirmed that I would always have a life in food in some form or another. And lately I've been talking a lot about this. I don't really think I learned to cook in restaurants. I learned how restaurants work. I learned about the hierarchy, and I learned the systems, and I learned organization. And I watched a lot, and I asked a lot of questions. But I didn't really learn to cook until I cooked for my kids in my kitchen for the past 17 years. But I still, you know, sort of what I write about, that idea that my heart is racing even in my kitchen today. Sometimes I just don't know how to cook without that sort of, without adrenaline and without intensity.
Can you talk a bit about your decision stylistically in writing the memoir as a bit of both poetry and prose?
Well, I started a blog called Dash and Bella about 10 years ago. I haven't blogged for a few years now because I was working on this book, but it was a great place to play with different styles of writing. So that's sort of where I started paring things down and writing things in the second person or in a very spare manner. And it was a very safe place to play in some ways, especially since they were short stories about my life with a recipe and a photo. But with the book, I actually wrote a very different book about 7 years ago. I had a book deal with a different publisher, and I ended up writing a very bloated memoir that was hundreds and hundreds of pages longer than this one. And things sort of exploded with that book deal, and I like to think I got my book back in the best way, because then I got to pare it down to what it is today over the next 3 or 4 years. So I just felt like as I pared it down, it became a little, not a little more, a lot more universal. It's more of the essence of these milestones in my life, and hopefully more accessible to people and more familiar. Like, people hopefully sometimes feel like they're reading their stories and my stories.
That's so interesting. Your book does have some recipes. Could you choose one that kind of sums up where you're at right now?
That's really hard. I have 17 recipes in this book, and I'm pretty much making all of them all the time. But tart dough is one I've been thinking a lot about this week. But for one thing, I was teaching some high school seniors over video how to make the tart dough. And I filmed it, and it was 17 minutes from beginning to end just making the tart dough. And I realized what a meditation it is for me to make it. And I love talking about that meditation and showing all the details. And partly why I love tart dough now is it can extend into so many directions. It can be sweet. It can be savory. You can half bake the tart, you can bake a slice, you can make mini tarts. I feel like it extends into, or potentially can extend into many more meals. And also, just tarts generally make people pretty happy.
Yes, they do. Well, thank you so much, Phyllis.
Oh, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you.
You too. Take care.
You too. Thanks.
That is Phyllis Grant. Her book that we gave you just a little taste of is Everything is Under Control. Coming up, when her sister gave birth in the height of New York City's COVID crisis, Charlene Wang was determined to cook for her, even if they couldn't be together. Charlene shares her story next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Rituals. They're customs and steps that we take systematically to honor tradition, but can be as simple as our morning coffee. The pandemic's put a damper on many rituals, even though we need to mark time more than ever. But Charlene Wang, she went ahead with the Chinese practice of postpartum recovery for her sister anyway. And she wrote about it for Bon Appetit's Healthy-ish. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, Evan.
I'm so happy that we finally have you here to talk about this.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
I would love if you could read the first paragraph of your essay.
Sure. At 3:57 a.m. on Monday, March 30th, I was awoken by a text from my brother-in-law. Baby girl Ruby was born at 1:09 a.m. It was my sister's first baby and our parents' first grandchild. After exchanging excited messages with my family in our group chat, I got out of bed and walked to the still dark kitchen. I picked up a piece of ginger and a spoon, and standing over the sink began doing what newly minted Chinese aunts have done for thousands of years. Upon receiving news of a birth in the family, I started peeling ginger.
Why did you do this? Why did you get out of bed in the dark and start prepping ginger?
I knew that once my sister gave birth, that I was going to try to right away bring her some ginger egg fried rice and bring her some of the dried jujube goji berry ginger drink. And, well, the thing that's in both is ginger. But also I feel like ginger has this almost totemic quality in Chinese cuisine, especially Southern Chinese cuisine. I feel like anytime you're dizzy or have a stomach ache or just like really anything, the answer always seems to be ginger, according to my mom and grandma. And so I feel like ginger as an ingredient has levitated to this like holy status in our family and I think many Chinese people's mind.
But this ginger in this instance sort of had more import. It was one of the first steps on your way to fulfilling this tradition, this ritual that many postpartum women family members do for a beloved daughter or granddaughter or a sister, as in your case. Can you tell us about this practice?
So there is an ancient Chinese postpartum ritual and food practice called Zuo Yezi, and it actually involves two things. It involves confinement and it involves food. With COVID, the confinement part, pretty much the whole world was doing that. But the food part involves a lot of sort of programmatic and ritualistic foods that are made. And if you talk to any woman in the Chinese diaspora who gave birth, they pretty much know exactly what foods you're making. And it's similar foods that have been made for centuries. So the ginger that I was peeling that morning was one of the key ingredients for two very typical foods in the Zuo Yezi menu.
What is the English translation of the Chinese phrase?
It means sitting a month, but like actually very literally, it means sitting a moon cycle. And the word for month is the same character for moon in Chinese.
You're a fourth generation Chinese American, and yet there was no way you weren't going to go ahead with this ritual that would kind of upend your world that was already torn apart. Your mom had planned to come and stay with you and mm-hmm. do it, but because of travel restrictions, mm-hmm. et cetera, she wasn't able to do it, so it fell onto you. Why do you think this particular ritual has so much power, and even generations after immigration, there's such a link to making it and feeding the loved, recently birthed mom these foods?
Yeah. I think it's because, you know, there's just so much vulnerability that happens in any birth. And I feel that everyone understands how vulnerable and delicate that transition is. And everyone is scared, and everyone is extra scared in a time of COVID. So having a very clear program and this ancient ritual felt very grounding. And it was like, okay, I can just follow directions. And it's worked for people for hundreds of years. So great, I can just do this, as opposed to just the whole whirlwind of murky uncertainty that the rest of the world was swirling in.
Where did you learn which recipes to make? Was it from your mom?
So the funny thing is, my mom actually didn't really know how to make any of the recipes either. So before we decided she wasn't going to come, she herself was stressed out about how to make these recipes. She was binging on YouTube videos, and she was constantly asking my sister and I to, can you find someone? Can we hire someone? Can you find someone in New York who will come to your house and cook? That's like a common service. Just find them. So the way I learned was, When I realized, okay, well, I guess now I have to figure this out, I was talking to one of my best friends, and she's like, oh, there's this book. It's perfect for you. And the book is The First 40 Days, written by a Chinese-American traditional Chinese medicine practitioner, Hung O. And my friend sent me a copy of her book immediately, and I just gave myself over to the book.
And the purpose of all these dishes, is it to build the mother back up, to enhance the blood? Is it warming foods? Mm-hmm. What are some of the theories behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously not an expert, right? I'm someone who definitely did a COVID crash course on this. But from what I have learned, there's multi-purposes. Different foods serve different purposes. There's lactation-enhancing foods. There's circulation-boosting foods. There's warming foods. And there's foods also just to comfort and help nourish a mother whose body has just delivered a human out of it. And the book does, you know, explain them and set the context and try to introduce the principles and ideas.
It must have been especially challenging as this happened amidst the run on the grocery stores, and it was before when people were still hoarding and before online, mm-hmm. Even little stores managed to find their way online.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that was one of the hardest challenges I felt in the beginning. I remember the day that my sister gave birth, like, okay, let's go buy the special ingredients now. And we drove to the biggest Asian grocery store close by to me, and they were totally sold out of all meat, like completely sold out. And I was like, okay, I guess we're going to have to think of some other backup plans to just get these base, not even specialty ingredients, right? Just like meat, like chicken. That was a very challenging aspect of it.
During the 40 days of feeding your sister, what were one or two of her favorite dishes that that you feel you might make again, even not in this particular context?
Yeah, so one of them I actually had made for myself again. and it's this dried jujube, goji berry, ginger, herbal tonic. It's really, my sister said she loved it right away. And when I was making it, it smelled like I was in my grandmother's home. Because my grandma always made us different Chinese medicinal soups at all times. Like if when we went, my grandma was in Boston and I grew up in California. When we went to go visit her, she always had a bowl of soup waiting for us the second we arrived. Because she's like, oh, you need this soup to nourish you from your travels. And like if you had a cramp or a headache, she had a soup. Like she was always making soups and broths, and that drink smelled like them. And then the other one that my sister really liked, which we were all sort of surprised by, was the papaya fish soup, which is, according to the book, the second most popular and most well-known and common zuoyizi food. It's a soup made for lactation. I was surprised that the papaya and fish combination turned out to be something my sister enjoyed drinking, so that was great.
When you say papaya, do you mean a green papaya or a ripe, mature, sweet papaya?
A ripe, mature, sweet papaya.
Wow, really?
So you make a fish broth. Yes, it's so fascinating, right? You make a fish broth, the whole fish, with like tomatoes and spring onions. And you know, I've learned how much faith Chinese people put into dried jujubes because they're in almost every dish in the zuoyizi canon. And then at a certain point, you add diced up ripe papayas.
Wow, how interesting. Can you share with us what it was like when you picked the family up from the hospital, Tiffany, her husband, and baby Ruby?
Yeah. It was, of course, it was exciting, right? We're going to pick them up from the hospital, we're going to take them home, and we're going to see Ruby for the first time. But it was also totally haunting because the route we took is I drive down FDR Highway on Manhattan. And then the exit we take to drive into the hospitals past a bunch of hospitals, and we could see all the cold storage trailers that were parked outside that were there because there was a surplus of dead bodies, which is probably the most haunting image that I saw with my own eyes. It was so surreal. And it was like extra surreal because we saw that on the way to pick up a newborn baby.
Wow. Have you gotten to hold Ruby yet?
Yeah, so it took 76 days until the first time I was able to hold her. We did it outdoors and I was wearing a mask, but it was wonderful. And then actually my parents were finally able to travel from Orange County, California to New York on July 2nd. They traveled here and then they quarantined at our apartment for 2 weeks. So they quarantined for 2 weeks and then they were able to go visit Ruby and stay with my sister, and we were all able to see each other without masks and hold Ruby and play with her, and everyone was kind of floating on a cloud of bliss for like 9 days of our family finally being able to be together, and all of us just get to cherish and adore Ruby.
That was Charlene Wang. We have a link to the piece she wrote for Healthy-ish on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. The restaurant closings are starting to roll in. Luda Lefebvre's groundbreaking Trois Mecs and the equally lauded Here's Looking at You are just two examples. As the pandemic continues to inflict pain on the restaurant industry, we check in with Eater LA editor Matthew Kang, who reported on the toll COVID-19 is taking on Koreatown and the loss of a beloved restaurant, Jun Wan. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about Jun Wan. I know that this is a restaurant that you have gone to for years. Jeff Jun announced last Sunday the closure on Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, he actually called me on Friday afternoon and he just sounded really exasperated and felt like he was just giving up. And, you know, it was a long journey for him and his mother, Chung Ye-jun, who founded the restaurant in 1996 in a very humble, small space on 8th Street that was, for many years, just an unsung gem of Koreatown, serving great traditional Korean dishes, making all their banchan in-house. And then they sadly closed in 2016 and then reopened in 2016, later that year, on a wonderful little spot on Western Avenue. And it continued to run there for nearly 4 years until this week, which will be its final week of business.
How old were you when you started eating there?
You know, it's very interesting. A lot of Koreatown restaurants just felt familiar to me. I never knew the name growing up. And it wasn't until I was in college when I had a car and I was able to drive around on my own and find these places that I could, you know, actually rediscover them in a sense. I don't know if I'd been to Jun Wan as a child, but stepping in there, something felt very familiar. And I probably went there notably for the first time, I want to say, 10 years ago. And I just remember just being blown away by, you know, just these classic dishes, haemul-bajeon, seafood pancake. I love their ndaegujoreum, which is their spicy braised black cod with like these big discs of super tender Korean daikon radish. Even their classic like bulgogi or their spicy pork bulgogi, unbelievable. That restaurant is so emblematic of like what a great mom and pop Korean restaurant should be. And it was truly one of LA's best. And it's so, so sad to see it closing its chapter.
There were a few factors that contributed to the restaurant not being able to make takeout or al fresco dining work. What were they?
I mean, they said early on, when I talked to Jeff, he was one of the people that I kept in constant contact with during the pandemic. He, of course, immediately closed down all operations and never had any intention of opening up dine-in, even when the county had allowed it for a short period. So he was going to try to lean on takeout. But the thing is, he told me on last Friday, he said, you know, we try to do takeout, but our dishes are just not, they're just not really conducive to takeout. I mean, they're kind of bigger, more elaborate plates, sometimes $20, $30, close to $40. They just weren't very approachable price point wise. And I think a lot of the people went to Jun Wan, not necessarily for its amazing atmosphere, but just to be able to be treated almost like you were going to an aunt's or a grandma's house, where you could get a huge spread of banchan and everything could just be presented for you on this table. And you lose some of that magic with takeout. Korean food is traditionally very good with takeout, especially if it's like a one bowl type meal. If it's sundubu or seolleongtang or one of these soups, you just sort of get this big vat of soup and then you get a bunch of banchan and it's all in these styrofoam containers and it's very well done. But Jun Wan is such a great traditional restaurant with these more complex dishes that just didn't really translate for takeout. It's really, really unfortunate, but I do hope that, you know, Jeff is pretty young. His mother is in her 70s, so she was probably ready to, you know, retire anyways. But, you know, Jeff is a younger guy, and I think he's one of the few, like, second-generation Korean restaurant owners in Koreatown. You know, most of the mom-and-pop places that opened in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s are starting to go away, and they're being replaced by like corporate-owned or chain restaurants from South Korea. And so I think the golden era of the traditional Korean restaurant is going to go away, and the pandemic is making it just a lot worse. I don't think many more of them are going to be able to hold on.
That makes me so incredibly sad, because I've been thinking a lot about this, how so much of the LA landscape, the texture of why it's so great to eat here is what there is in Koreatown. Just a ton of family run independent restaurants that range from mom and pop casual to Michelin star like Jun Wong. And how important it is to have these restaurants that span generations to really give a sense of belonging and ownership of a neighborhood to the whole city.
Yeah, I mean, Koreatown is a hub. It may not be the largest center of, you know, where Koreans actually live. Korean Americans in the LA area, I mean, it goes all the way out to Valencia and Diamond Bar and Irvine. But in a way, LA's Koreatown was the hub where everyone came, where they would get groceries, where they would go to church. It would be the place you can meet all your friends. All the hair salons are there. It is the center of the Korean American community in Southern California. And I mean, a lot of these immigrant restaurants are not intended to be generational. The original founders of these restaurants, they don't want their children to be restaurateurs. They want them to be lawyers and doctors and businessmen and businesswomen. And the crop of second generation people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, like myself, who are looking to take over their parents' business, it's just not very common. And, you know, when you lose what I think is the single best, you know, enclave of international food in LA's Koreatown, when you start to lose some of that character, then it takes a toll on what LA's dining scene really is. I don't think Koreatown's going just yet. I think there's a lot of fighting spirit in Koreans and Korean immigrants. But I just think that Chunwon closing is, to me, a signal that that golden era of those great restaurants is coming to an end.
One wishes that someone set them up on Talk. I feel like they would have been really successful on Talk.
Interestingly enough, this last week, he's been part of an initiative called, I think, Mama's Kitchen, where this one group has a much greater social media reach and was able to fulfill a ton of pre-orders, sort of a last week's hurrah of getting fans and people engaged across the city. And so what they do is they allow people to make pre-orders online, and then they can pick up in three different parts of the city, all the way down to Irvine.
Yeah, Mama's Drive-By Kitchen. I went online, yeah, and they were completely sold out of all orders, like 2 seconds after you guys posted it on Eater.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how I think you and I both can relate to this, Evan. Like, we were both business operators for many years, and there's something that happens, like, you know, when you say you're about to close, a lot of people just kind of come out and go like, oh my gosh, you know, it's finally going, and they want to pay their last respect, and you're just like, man, where were you? I think for Chunwon, you know, they were around for 24 years. They had a Banchan store on 8th Street. I mean, Chung Ye-jeon and her imprint that she leaves on Koreatown will be felt for a long time. And I wouldn't doubt that Jeff, you know, he's a younger guy. I think he's tenacious. He's going to come back and do something when this pandemic is over and the economy recovers.
Thank you so much, Matt. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this.
Of course. Thank you. And thanks for allowing me to shine a spotlight on Koreatown, my most beloved LA neighborhood.
You're not alone. That's Matthew Kang, editor of Eater LA. We've been discussing the closure of Jun Wan in Koreatown. In a minute, it's the Choose Your Own Adventure cookbook that jolted me out of my cooking rut. I'll share it with you next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Remember those Choose Your Own Adventure books you read as a kid? Well, Charlotte Druckman has developed a Pick Your Adventure cookbook using pantry staples and other ingredients. 25 sets of three ingredients with three recipes each are the premise of her latest work, Kitchen Remix. It's the perfect antidote to that cooking fatigue we're all feeling while staying a bit too close to home. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Evan.
I understand that you had your brother in mind when you were working on this book.
Yes, my brother, who has not cooked any single thing during quarantine at all, ironically. I did have him in mind, and I think I had people like him in mind, meaning people who really love food and are really open-minded and adventurous in terms of trying things they haven't had before and wanting to explore different flavors and being very, you know, restaurant-focused. And yet, if you look at what's happening in their kitchen, you see a real disconnect. You see people who either can't cook or are lacking the confidence or just extremely kind of timid about it. So their repertoire for what they're making at home is as limited as their palates are unlimited. And I thought, how do you bridge that gap? How do you get them to want to be in their kitchens and want to be more comfortable, but feel like they're getting some of the same payoff in terms of the diversity of flavors and food that they would get if they were going out to eat?
One of the things I found so interesting about this book is how fascinated I was to see how someone else's palate drives choice. So let's just dive in. Let's start with zucchini, pistachio, and mint.
Yes.
Explain to us how you approach it.
Well, I'm happy that you asked me this because no one's really asked me how the trios came together. And I'd been thinking about sort of how they did because it's been a while since the creative process, which I enjoyed so much, by the way. But a lot of times it would start with one dish. Sometimes it would be, okay, you need to do something that's more vegetal or you need something that's more salad-y. But a lot of times it would start with just one dish. And I think in the case of the zucchini, I was thinking about a salad that I'd had years ago in Tuscany. And it was a salad with raw zucchini, avocado, salt, pepper, pine nuts, and, which is weird because this is an ingredient I usually do not endorse, truffle oil. And first of all, I'd never been someone who really considered raw zucchini as an ingredient, and an ingredient that would be sort of the anchor for an entire dish. I loved this salad so much that when I came home from Italy, I kept making it over and over again. And when I was thinking about this trio, I think that the anchor recipe for me was, in fact, this idea of doing a salad with raw zucchini. I also was looking through one of Sky Gingell, the British chef's cookbooks, her newer one. I want to say it's for her restaurant Spring. And she had this recipe for zucchini that had been cooked down a lot and had a bunch of different, I think, spices and herbs in it. And it looked that sort of what everyone else calls, I guess, ugly delicious, but to me looks really beautiful because it's just this like total bright greenish mush that just looks like a ragu of zucchini. And I feel like those were the two where I started to play. And then once I'd come up with this idea that, okay, it's going to be zucchini and it's going to be pistachio and mint, you know, doing a zucchini cake seemed so obvious. And then doing a zucchini cake that had pistachio and mints in it seemed just different enough, but familiar too. It's still pretty classic because it's still predominantly a zucchini cake. So, or zucchini bread, I should say.
What's interesting to me about this book, too, is that it's more ingredient than technique driven. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I think it's a fair assessment. But what I think happens is that I don't like to be redundant. So, I mean, there are certain techniques and things that repeat. But within a trio, I was always kind of thinking, well, if you've already done a recipe where you roasted this ingredient, in the next one, why don't you do it where you're braising it? Or, you know, so that you are sort of secretly learning different techniques. You're learning a few different ways to cook the same thing. But really, the focus is on how do you approach ingredients? How do you think about ingredients? How do you think about putting them together? And then, in addition, how do you think about cooking them?
So let's do another vegetable trio. Let's do carrot, cashews, and coconut.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what the trio of recipes is. What are the three dishes?
Okay, so for this one, the trio is roasted carrots with, they're sort of curry roasted. They're tossed in some curry powder and a few other spices. And then they're given a cashew cream that they're drizzled with and some cashews, some spice roasted cashews. And I really, this is one dish in the book that I think there are a few dishes that might be sort of like inadvertently vegan, but I really wanted to have a vegan dish in the recipe that was really what I thought of as a vegetable showstopper that could eat like a meal. And that was what I wanted that dish to be. Another dish is a carrot salad that is based on a Thai papaya salad, just in terms of that sort of sweet and sour heat behind it. So it's shredded carrots and then with a bit of shredded coconut, which I really love what that does for the texture of the salad. And then there are cashews in that instead of having maybe, you know, peanuts on top, which you would find in a papaya salad. And then the last recipe, which was actually what started this trio, and it was something I did, it was the first recipe for the book I did before I even knew I was doing the book. And so once I knew I was doing the book, I knew I would be doing a carrot, cashew, coconut trio because I thought this recipe has to be in it. I'd had this idea that I wanted to try to do a carrot upside down cake, meaning the way you would do like an, you know, a pineapple upside down cake where the carrots are in the bottom of your skillet and they get caramelized and they become this beautiful top of your cake when you flip them over so that it wasn't a carrot cake as we know it. And the base of the cake is actually coconut. And then the cashews are part of that carrot topping, caramel, whatever you want to call it, that tops the cake.
Wow. I mean, the great idea of this to me is we all get set in our ways because it becomes easy. So I see a carrot and I want to do X with it. And I end up doing X with it over and over and over again. And this just takes you a bit out of your comfort zone and reveals to you the unbelievable variety that exists right now in your kitchen with the same stuff that you've played with in a much less exuberant way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that was definitely part of it. I was having this conversation with Paula Forbes about cookbooks, and I was saying how I get frustrated with the phenomenon of viral recipes because I think what happens in that case is that people get so fixated on a recipe so that they know how to make this one thing. But it doesn't teach them anything about how to cook in general. It doesn't, you know, it's like, I know how to make this one roast chicken, and that's great. But then do you understand how you could apply that to making other roast chickens? Have you even thought to do that, or is it just the chicken? And have you thought about other things you might do to the chicken? And Paula was saying how, you know, this mentality had also extended to cookbooks, where cookbooks really feel like just a book of individual recipes, right? And some of those recipes kind of get picked up on and people really take to them. But there's no kind of like holistic sense of the cookbooks working as a whole organism. And I was like, that's such a, you know, I thought that was such an interesting observation. And I think it's true. And I think it maybe if we go back to older cookbooks, we might feel like they held together more in that way, where they were teaching us something bigger than each recipe in the book was. So I kind of feel like for me, it was, yeah, how do you sort of show people how to be resourceful? How do you do that? And then you kind of have to be creative in order to show other people how to be creative.
Well, Charlotte, thank you so much. It's such an interesting book, and it's actually shaken me out of the doldrums of my usual stuff. So
I'll be making
some of the trios.
I'm really glad. And again, thank you for having me. I really love being on this show, and it was so good to just to hear you.
You too. Take care.
Thank you.
That's journalist and food writer Charlotte Druckman. Her cookbook is Kitchen Remix. Really, is there any place to get inspired for a kitchen remix that's better than the farmer's market? Good Food's Jillian Ferguson is at the market now with a special report from Hollywood.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm just outside the Hollywood Farmer's Market this week with Casey Felton, owner of Bunwee, which sits at Selma and Cahuenga right here in Hollywood. And if you shop the Hollywood Market, you know that one of the big changes after the pandemic was that prepared food vendors were no longer allowed to sell inside the market. And Casey, who is a shopper here, knew that that meant that the farmers wouldn't have anywhere to eat lunch, so her instinct was to feed them. This past Sunday marks the 15th week that she has essentially made family meal for the farmers here at the market. Hi, Casey.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's so exciting what you're doing. So take us back to that first Sunday. How quickly did you see a need for this, and how soon were you able to implement it?
Well, it came up pretty organically. I was just speaking with the market manager, Megan, and she had basically alerted me that the prepared food vendors wouldn't be able to serve here. And it just dawned on me that not being able to have lunch after getting here super early in the morning, hauling all of your stuff down here, and then to be welcomed by a market that was going to be probably fairly slow given what's going on. I wanted to be able to do something that would help out. Mind you, it wasn't completely all generosity. I was also really bored at work because we had seen a loss in our revenue quite a bit, and so we therefore had idle hands in the kitchen. So it became kind of like a creative project for myself and my crew, but then also an ability to give back to the community that has supported restaurants for a long time.
So tell us how it works. Are the farmers donating the produce every week?
They are. So that first week, we did it just initially to bring awareness to the possibility of a community effort. And after that first meal went out, we were really amazed with how quickly everyone kind of rallied together and started to give produce as soon as they had learned about it. Megan had sent an email out to the entire market to alert people that this is something that we would be working together to do. But it kind of just happened by word of mouth, which is great because it means that they liked the food and they were okay with me cooking for them.
And are the farmers paying for their meals or is it all pro bono?
It is all pro bono. So we are just offering basically our labor. And then given the produce that they give us, we create a new meal every single week, which can be extremely difficult, but also very fun because sometimes we get some really random ingredients and sometimes it just works out quite perfectly. Like this week, we got potatoes and beets, and those two things came into a Salvadorian potato beet salad, which is amazing.
Yeah, tell us about some of the meals that you've created.
Oh, boy. We've done quite a few, I think. What we said 15, right? So we've done a Thai shrimp curry. We've done a breakfast chile relleno poblano breakfast burrito, a summer salad with bell peppers, herbs, and tomatoes.
I saw a vegetarian cassoulet also, right?
We did do a vegetarian cassoulet, which typically has a lot of fat in it, which makes it so hearty and rich. So I feel like people are probably rolling their eyes being like, a vegetarian cassoulet, what did you add, a lot of coconut oil? And no, but it just meant that we gave a lot of love to it in the oven. It went low and slow for a really long time to allow for the richness and the heartiness of the beans and the tomatoes and the herbs to really lend to the dish.
Great. Well, it's very inspiring to see chefs and farmers come together in this way. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you so much.
That was Casey Felton. She's the owner of Bunwee in Hollywood. Roland Tamai is one of the farmers who's donated consistently to Casey. He farms on 3.5 acres in Oxnard, where he grows tomatoes, herbs, and cucumbers, which are peak season this time of year. Hi, Roland.
Hi there.
So I have to ask you about your last name, Tamai. For people who shop farmers markets in Southern California, Tamai is a name that we see at a lot of markets. Do you come from a large farming family?
Yes, I do. Actually, I am the third generation of growers, and I have some nephews that grow with my brother that are the fourth generation here in the United States.
So I know that no one is going to believe me when I say this, but I think one of the most compelling reasons to shop at the farmers market in the summertime is for cucumbers. It's one of those mundane grocery store items that gets really exciting when you start looking at the market because there's so many different varieties. You've got the Japanese cucumbers, you've got Armenian cucumbers, everyone knows the Persian cucumbers. You've got three on your table today. Tell us what you've got.
Today I have Persian cucumbers, the ones that are pretty common here in the farmer's market. But I also do a Chinese variety, which is the Suyu variety, which is a long cucumber that's pretty much in the same classification. It's a seedless, thin-skinned, burpless type of cucumber, which you can eat the skin and all. And then I also do a Japanese variety, which is one of the rough varieties, and very similar in texture, but a little bit different in taste to the Chinese one.
What does burpless mean?
Meaning that that you basically are really not going to burp because they don't carry as much of an air pocket inside. They're a little bit more dense than some of the American slicing types of cucumbers.
Wow, I had no idea what that meant. And part of that density means that they're extra crunchy as well, which I think is what makes them so satisfying.
Exactly.
So tell us about these ridges that are out on the outside of both the Japanese and the Chinese cucumber.
Well, those are kind of nature's way of protecting itself from certain animals and other things from eating them. When you pick them fresh on the vine, when they come off, they're actually very spiny and prickly. But after about a couple hours, those spines start to wilt and it's not as prickly. I think any pest or anything that's trying to eat them feels those spines and kind of stays away from them. We've learned that if we wash them off or we let them sit for a couple hours, then they're actually harmless at that point.
And describe how they grow. Do you have to trellis cucumbers?
These three particular varieties, I do trellis them. I have them in a greenhouse, and they're about 150 feet rows that are suspended by metal cables that I run along the top of the greenhouse, and I string up each plant and continue to string them. They're really high maintenance. You have to prune them each week. You have to take leaves off the bottom. You take all the suckers that come off of the nodes. And you have to continue to wrap the tops with the string so that they don't fall over and break. They can actually grow up to 6 inches in a day. That's how fast they grow.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Roland.
You are welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Roland Tamai. You can find him at the Sunday Hollywood, Saturday Torrance, and Wednesday Long Beach Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
I love cucumbers. But I have to say my favorite way to prepare them is a way that a Taiwanese friend of mine taught me. And that's just to slice them up and marinate them in a mixture of 2 parts soy sauce to 1 part of white vinegar. I throw in a little bit of chili garlic sauce, maybe a smashed garlic clove too, and some ginger if I have it. It's so good. Coming up, farmers in California's Central Valley have been hard hit by the coronavirus. We find out why the region is the latest hot zone of the virus and what the state is doing about it. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Earlier this week, Governor Gavin Newsom proposed new legislation to support California communities disproportionately hit by the coronavirus. The $52 million bills would fund testing and tracing. LA Times staff writer Anita Chabrier reported on the hit agricultural communities are taking from COVID-19, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. Hi, Anita.
Hi, Evan.
Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
What does the pandemic situation in San Joaquin look like now?
Devastating and dire for the Latino community and for the Black community and other communities of color. It is just really prevalent within the essential workers there. And you're seeing that play out across families, across industries. You're really seeing the crisis mount, not just in terms of those who are falling ill, but what illness means within those families in terms of lost wages, in terms of the ability to isolate from other family members, in terms of who's taking care of kids. It's really having devastating and far-reaching consequences.
What percentage of Latinos account for the most recent reported cases?
We actually don't know because there's discrepancies. So what the county is counting and what advocates say they're seeing in test results that they're familiar with are different. So, you know, it ranges anywhere from somewhere in the 40% all the way up to some are estimating that 70% of the new cases are in the Latino community.
And we should say that 93% of the state's agricultural workers are Latino.
That is absolutely true. And you look at other fields like food prep is above 60% Latino. A lot of our jobs that are those essential workers, the delivery drivers, the field workers, even when you get into medical fields, the technicians and things like that are Latino.
How has the pandemic amplified the exploitation of California's agricultural laborers?
The fault lines were always there. I don't believe that any of us aren't aware that farm workers have a long history of having to fight for rights from shade to clean water in the fields of California and across the country. What this has done is just amplify everything, and it's not done amplifying it. So we're seeing right now that it's a crisis for field workers, but 2 months from now, if we don't do something now, it's going to be 10 times worse.
And we're talking about a population of people that are more likely to live in multi-generational households, and those households tend to be in cramped quarters.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that you see across the spectrum when you're talking about poverty, no matter where it is more crowded living spaces. And so you do have more people in apartments and you do have multi-generational families there. And that is especially true when you get into migrant housing. So I think a lot of people aren't aware that the state actually owns migrant housing and it's run by then private contractors. And these are, you know, what in other circumstances might be considered project housing. Right? They're often very small, very basic, very old apartments that have several hundred families or at least 100 families living in them. And they're very tight. They're very crowded.
San Joaquin managed to dodge cases early on, but more than 3,700 of the 10,000 cases reported by the time you wrote your story came within the last 2 weeks. What mistakes did you see that were made in the early days of the pandemic?
You know, in San Joaquin's defense, I think it's the same mistakes that were made throughout the valley and throughout many other cities throughout the state, which is that we just didn't necessarily move quick enough. I think that was the biggest criticism that I heard from everyone is that, you know, perhaps in March, we didn't really understand what was happening. Even in April, maybe we were still figuring it out. But then you come to June and you're still not moving with a sense of urgency. And that's what I heard over and over again is that even these last weeks and months where we should have known that this was urgent, there was not that sense of urgency from the county in getting something done.
So many agricultural workers already wear a ton of clothing to protect themselves from the sun, and many usually work masked as well, just to protect themselves from pesticides and dust and pollen from the crops that they're gathering. Were they, for the most part, given good information about the importance of masking?
I'll give two answers to that. One, no. Over and over again, what I've heard from people is no, that they have not received the information that they would like to have. So the message has gotten there that you should wear a mask. But why and when and how and what it does and why you're doing it. Those messages that really help convince people and help explain the situation have not reached that community. And it is true that many field workers wear some kind of bandana or some kind of face covering for other reasons, but they're not wearing that when they're in crowded vans going to the field, and they're not wearing that during lunch, and they're taking that up and down as they drink water or share water or do all those kinds of things. And so I think that the idea that masks were something that they were already using really is a false sense of security because they weren't using them in the way that you would for protection from coronavirus.
So let's talk about this money that that the governor is trying to release for this area. What does testing look like now? And what discrepancies have there been with tracking cases?
Well, there are two state-sponsored testing sites in San Joaquin, and that is more than some places. And there's private testing available. But it is far from the idea, as it is across the state, that anyone who wants a test can get a test. And even more than that, when you're dealing with migrant farm workers, up to 60% of whom might not have documentation, you're dealing with a population that not only is fearful of deportation, but is fearful of cost, right? So there's so many hurdles right now for the farm worker population to be tested that there's really a sense that it needs to be in a way that is close by, maybe even mobile, brought out to them, and they feel safe from repercussions. So for example, taking testing to an employer makes a lot of people uncomfortable because if they test positive, that employer is going to know it's them and they're not going to have a job anymore. So it's overcoming those kind of hurdles, making people know that even if they are tested, they'll be taken care of financially, their families will be okay, that there won't be that kind of stigma or long-term loss, and that getting tested is available and okay to do.
Do you think that seasonal farming will be affected as we move into fall and winter crops?
100%. I mean, you're already seeing it affected. There's a ton of unemployment because there's so many fewer agricultural jobs this season. And, you know, this virus is not going anywhere. Even if we get it under control for our essential workers, it's still there. And so the effects are going to be there until there's a vaccine.
That's Anita Chabrier. She covers policy and politics for the Los Angeles Times. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go out to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks this week to Paul Smith, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Do yourself a favor. Cook something nice for yourself this week. Take a trip to the market if you can and pick up some cucumbers. And of course, I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.